without wanting to borrow a term from Love Island, Mike Ashley has put all his eggs in that basket.
Hi guys, welcome back to the Sports Pro Podcast. A bit of a different sound this week. Your regular host, Owen Connolly, is away. So it's me, digital editor, Tom Basson, taking over proceedings. I'm joined by our deputy editor, Sam Karp, to discuss all things Premier League ahead of the new season. We'll be looking at the ins and outs, what's been going on in the summer, and perhaps maybe if there's any COVID implications. Also, if you're very lucky and you manage to get to the end of the episode, you'll hear a few of our predictions for the new season. I won't take up too much more of your time, but let's just get straight into the conversation with me and Sam, shall we?
You're listening to the Sports Pro Podcast.
Probably best place to start, pre-season. I mean, very different this year with limited access to Asia, I would probably kindly say it as. What have you noticed about pre-season or coming into this season that stood out for you?
Probably that no one's really been going anywhere. It's you know, that's likely something that they've been getting used to now, having been unable to travel overseas last summer as well, when the turnaround between the 19-20 and 2021 seasons was even shorter. Secretly, you know, I reckon some managers are probably quite pleased that they haven't had to cart their players halfway across the world. But as we know, pre-season tours have become commercially very valuable to these clubs. You mentioned Asia there, also the US. You know, they're as much about building a global brand as they are about kind of getting your players up to optimal fitness levels. So yeah, there are opportunities to connect with fans in other markets, to engage with regional partners as well. So, you know, the fact that they're missing out on that revenue for a second summer in a row will be a bit of a blow. Yeah, I was reading a piece in The Guardian actually, which said Manchester United generated £12 million in appearance fees from their trip across Perth, Singapore, Shanghai and Oslo in 2019. Obviously, not every club has the same kind of pull as United, but you'd imagine that they won't have gained quite as much from their cancelled game against Preston last weekend and their jaunt up to St Andrews in Scotland, my old stomping ground, as you know well, Tom, for a pre-season training camp at the start of this month. Everton, I think, were maybe the only ones who did manage to get out to the US to play Millonarios in the Florida Cup. But then you had Arsenal withdrawing due to a number of cases in their touring party. I think some clubs have ventured a little bit deeper into Europe, but, you know, for the most part, because of quarantine, because of the difficulty travelling, because of, you know, the impact that just one positive case can have, we've seen most clubs staying very close to home, which, you know, has seen peculiar situations like Arsenal playing Spurs in a North London derby as a friendly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think as many clubs have ever been to Scotland as they have been this summer. Brighton definitely did a little tour around there. Definitely been a couple of others as well. There was a couple of interesting stories about those trips that did make it abroad and highlighted perhaps some of the more interesting choices amongst the Premier League players. I think Fabian Delph was trending on Twitter as an anti-vaxxer for his stance on that subject, meant that he couldn't go on the pre-season tour, which rounded off what I don't think was a great week for Everton. I don't think we need to talk about the other subject. I guess the other thing that's been missing as well is the Premier League Asia Trophy, which it usually gives the Premier League a chance to take some of the lesser sides over to play some games in China, which is a key brand building part for them, I think. Obviously, the big clubs are great at managing that exposure and managing their own tours over there. But some of the smaller ones, I mean, I think Wolves have taken part in this. West Brom, I believe, maybe in the last few years too. Have gone over to grow their brand, I guess, a little bit under the Premier League banner. So it's, a bit of a different one. I imagine that the commercial departments haven't been particularly happy, but the playing departments have probably thought, this is great. We don't have to worry about the impact of travel on our players, fatigue, or all of that kind of stuff going into a new season. Can just focus on getting their team ready. Although I guess probably another aspect that we haven't thought of is the impact of the Olympics too. So I think there was something absurd about Richarlison's travel schedule this summer, jetting from the Copa America to the Olympics and back again for pre-season, and the impacts that having. So a different summer, maybe the last we'll see of this kind of COVID legacy, perhaps. But a challenge nonetheless that the Premier League teams will have to deal with. But I guess it kind of leads us neatly on to the other side of this, which is what we're going to see when the league kicks off. So, I mean, I think it's been confirmed that pretty much every single club is going to have some kind of policy in place for managing fans back into full venues. So it's going to be full stadia again. Vaccines and negative tests and stuff has all been, I think that's team by team, right, Sam?
I think the Premier League this week did provide a little bit more clarity on the situation by providing some guidelines for fans being back. So I think originally you'd only had, the reason I actually know this is because I bought a ticket for Chelsea away on Saturday and I had already found out that I was going to have to either provide a proof of full vaccination or a negative test. And I think it was only Spurs and your beloved Brighton that had kind of already announced that they were going to do that as well. But now the Premier League has kind of said that that's going to be a requirement across the league. They've also said that there's going to be random spot checks during the first few weeks of the season. And they're introducing what they've described as a supporter code of conduct. So masks are going to have to be worn in indoor areas, avoiding contact with people you don't know, which is something you'd hope people were kind of doing already, actually. And also following one-way signage around the stadium. So, yeah, I suppose while things are getting back to normal, there are still elements of the match-going experience that is going to be a little bit different for the time being. But one that, you know, I'm sure most fans will be happy to oblige with if it means that they're able to go to games again after being deprived of live Premier League football for so long. I guess the sort of more delicate conversation to be had is around sort of the mandatory vaccine situation for supporters and players, which the UK government has been reportedly considering because, you know, as we know, not everyone is keen to get jabbed.
I mean, I mentioned Fabian Delph already on this, but I'm sure there's a few others that have probably not been reported as widely. But it's a difficult subject. I mean, I say a difficult subject. My personal take on this is that it shouldn't be a difficult subject. It should be a very straightforward subject. And that, like, whilst it's a, you can describe it as a personal choice, I think for players, you've got to understand it's actually not a personal choice. It's a societal choice, isn't it? I mean, maybe you disagree, but that's my take on it. You're not really getting this vaccine for yourself. You're getting this vaccine for everyone else that's protected by it. And maybe that message has got lost a little bit in the idea that it is a personal thing. Maybe that's slightly unfair, but the idea that, like, a Premier League footballer, I don't know, we hold them up as role models, whether that's fair or not. But I wouldn't have a problem personally with the Premier League saying, if you want to play, you've got to be vaccinated, because if you're the person that isn't and you get and you're out of the team for the reason of having a COVID, well, really, that's your choice, isn't it? It's not like you've pulled a hamstring or not warmed up properly or slipped in the shower. You've personally chosen to not do something, and that means that you're damaging the progress of your team. So it's a testy one, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I know that in other leagues, such as the NFL, they've talked about implementing rules where a COVID outbreak is caused by an unvaccinated player or staff, then the team with the outbreak will forfeit the game. I guess obviously the NFL has maybe a little bit more reason to be stricter with its punishments, given that, you know, they can't be quite as flexible with its schedule like the Premier League can. So if there were to be another postponement this year of a specific game, it would be easier for the Premier League to kind of slot that in further down the line. Just moving the conversation on a little bit to the fan side of it, I suspect that clubs are kind of fully aware that there will be groups of people within their fan base who maybe won't have been vaccinated, don't really have the intention of getting vaccinated, and will be very conscious about kind of alienating them and the potential impact that would have on, you know, their attendances, their revenues, especially after 1.5 seasons of playing behind closed doors. You know, it's important to remember that the Premier League hasn't been immune to the pandemic entirely. Revenue fell during the 2019-20 season. It's going to fall again for the 2020-2021 season when those figures are released and collated. So, you know, the big way that they're going to return to pre-pandemic levels is basically by selling out stadiums and getting that income stream moving again.
Yeah, I guess kind of on the other side, maybe clubs would be wanting to protect fans, and the way they can do that is by ensuring that everyone who shows up is protected as well as they can be. I mean, probably the last thing they'd want is a mass outbreak at one of their games. And also the reason for that being that maybe then, like, a low proportion of their fan base has been vaccinated. Like, it's been interesting, actually. Like, I don't know if this is the same in your area of London, but I've seen a lot of kind of promotional stuff. I mean, it's popped up on my Instagram feed. It pops up on the tubes. It pops up on ads at the bus stops about getting vaccinated at the football grounds. I know Arsenal and Tottenham have both run major vaccination programs at venues themselves. So I think, like, I think the clubs have been really good on this, actually, about taking a proactive stance in pushing things forward, because they probably realize that it's good for business.
Yeah, I suppose that's kind of what they need to balance, though, isn't it? It's kind of that that want to get people back in and the financial benefits that come with that. You've got to kind of balance that with the moral responsibility, as you say, because this is really the first time when we're going to have, you know, regular big crowds at football again. You know, what we're about to embark upon is pretty much full stadiums up and down the country every weekend. And you kind of compare it with other countries such as Italy, where I think Serie A is going to start at 50%, La Liga at 40%, and Bundesliga allowing up to 25,000. You know, it's not quite consistent with what everyone else is doing. So it is going to be kind of interesting to watch. One thing I'm also actually keen to get your take on, Tom, is do you think that people are going to flock back again? Like, do you think we're just going to see full stadiums from the get-go?
I think the evidence and the kind of the sporting summer that we've seen, so Wimbledon, the cricket with 100 and also the test matches, I think there's a real appetite to get back that probably outstrips the fears, I guess. I mean, I don't know about every single club in the Premier League, but I imagine that most will have a fan base big enough that those who are hesitant are the ones that probably don't get tickets, but probably the hardcore and a large group will want to get back in as soon as possible. They've been just starved of seeing their teams for such a long time. I mean, there was a couple of games at the end of last season, a couple of games in December, but personally speaking, I'm potentially going to the Watford game and very, very excited about that prospect. And the kind of, especially having had both jabs now, I feel that pretty safe in going back and just looking forward to that whole day experience of going to a football match, which is something that, like, watching at home, it's just not possible to recreate. Enough people will be excited about that, that any kind of hesitancy about being in a large crowd would quickly be forgotten.
I've been thinking about it. I'm not entirely sure, just because some of those reasons that I mentioned earlier. Yeah, I'm not saying that ground's going to be like half empty. Obviously, I think the Community Shield at the weekend between Leicester and City, I think it depended on kind of what camera angle you had, but there were large parts of the stadium which didn't look that busy. But I know the Community Shield effectively is a glorified friendly, so that's perhaps not a fair judge.
You also had Man City, who like, basically their fans don't go to Wembley unless it's a cup final. So
I think you also, if you add in the cost element, we were actually sent some data the other day that the cheapest season ticket price across all the clubs this season ranges from £807 at Spurs, which is the cheapest season ticket at Spurs, by the way, to £320 at West Ham, which, you know, it's a lot of money, especially given, you know, the financial difficulties that some people will have been through in the past year. So I think when you factor that in, you know, I'm not privy to kind of information about how well season ticket sales have been going for clubs, whether they've kind of matched what they were for the 2019-20 season, for example. But if they are sort of, if they do kind of have to make up some sort of gap with, you know, just people who buy a ticket for a one-off game, it might be trickier to do that. Because also, let's not forget that you're maybe not going to have tourists attending games, which, you know, a lot of Premier League games now, you do get quite a lot of tourists going to games. Travel is still kind of not back to normal. So I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking it, Tom, but I've been thinking about it a little bit.
I mean, I think that the travel stuff, I hadn't really kind of factored into it, but you could be right. And yeah, also the finance stuff too. It would be interesting to track. I guess it would depend on, some of the fixture. I think it'd probably be a little bit fixture by fixture, but yeah, those kind of big tourist days out at Old Trafford and the empty had probably going to be less appealing. Shall we move on? I feel like we've covered the return to fans there, and we could probably go on to, I don't know, what else have we got coming up for this new season? One of the kind of interesting things, I guess, has been the shift in sponsorship. So it's something we've talked about at Sports Pro for a while and covered a lot. It's the kind of decline of gambling brands on kit sponsors. We've seen a few, Watford being the one that I can think of the top of my head, signing up with another gambling brand. But didn't you have some interesting data around the shift in the, which sectors are acquiring shirt sponsorships, right?
Yeah, so actually the data doesn't actually show that much about a decline in bet. I know that we saw, there was like a study a few weeks ago, which we covered definitely, which was saying that across UK sport, there's that, you know, betting sponsorship is kind of in decline, but I'm not sure that's quite true for the Premier League just yet. Yeah, the infographic, I should credit where I got the infographic from, actually. It was from a company called Data Power. Basically, it sort of tracked how it's changed from back when the league started in the early 90s. I'll actually see if you can guess this, Tom. Can you guess what sector was the most prevalent in shirt sponsorship in the Premier League?
Hardware?
Electronics brands were there with 33%. So they had 33% of the deals when the league started. Then you had fashion companies were involved, food and drink businesses, household brands, news services, construction firms, and then kind of companies involved in the vehicle industry, so car makers. And then today, of those sectors that I've just mentioned, only the vehicle sector is still involved in Premier League shirt sponsorship. So kind of unsurprisingly, there's still a heavy reliance on betting brands going into this season. So you've got 45% of the shirt deals in the league held by them, so 9 of the 20. Then you have 20% held by financial services firms, 15% by companies in the vehicle sector, which now includes, your likes of Cazoo, 10% by airlines, and then there's one deal each for telecommunications and software companies. You know, it suggests that while there is a lot of focus on betting and the future of betting sponsorship, Premier League teams aren't necessarily abandoning that route just yet. Yeah, and I think sort of one of the most interesting cases is probably Burnley. Really, it seems like a random one to pick out, but so they signed a new deal about a month ago, I think it was, with a betting company called Spreadex. And so yeah, the reason it was kind of interesting is because Alan Pace, the club's owner, when he took over the club at the turn of the year, he basically said he was going to review the club's relationship with the gambling industry. Lovebet was their sponsor at the time. They were paying a reported £7.5 million a year. And kind of, you know, the fact that they've left the Lovebet sponsorship behind but have entered another partnership with a gambling company kind of suggests that it is proving quite difficult for clubs to source that kind of sponsorship revenue from companies outside the gambling sector, which, you know, is obviously quite pertinent given the fact that the UK government is currently conducting a review into, you know, the future of betting sponsorship in sport.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what would happen if, say, the Premier League was to go down a similar line to La Liga or Serie A with a sort of an outright ban on those kind of deals. But the Burnley case is interesting, actually. I hadn't really clocked that, but I remember at the time thinking Alan Pace is coming in and saying that we're going to maybe look to shift away from gambling sponsorships. What, like, who do Burnley go to go get that money? And actually, probably there's like limited options. How is that? I mean, just looking at that table a little bit, has that gone down, that number? I mean, 9, I feel like a couple of years ago it was up in the higher teens for shirt sponsorships.
I think it stayed pretty consistent. There's usually sort of 10, 11 clubs who do have a betting sponsor. And it's always kind of the same tier of club in a way, if you see what I mean. So you've got your Palace, your Crystal Palaces, your Burnleys. I know that Brighton have a unique relationship with American Express. Yeah, I think it's harder for these smaller clubs to kind of, it's harder for them to come up to attract a company like a Team Viewer or like a Three, like Chelsea has, or like an Emirates as Arsenal do. So, you know, when you do get a sort of a betting company that no one really knows too much about offering you the kind of money that they are, when you're not getting that same kind of offer elsewhere, I think it's pretty difficult for those clubs to turn it down. And it was interesting, actually, you mentioned Serie A, because there was a report last week that, you know, they're trying to overturn the ban on betting sponsorships in Italy as a means to kind of, you know, bring some more revenue in the wake of the pandemic and, you know, help clubs out, basically, which sort of goes to show that the impact that this could have if a ban were to come in over here.
Yeah, I think one of the, maybe less Serie A, because it's a kind of a bit of a basket case league with regards to how it's run, and especially where the money comes from. But La Liga, which I think is probably like the closest to the Premier League in terms of its commercial model. I mean, we saw Sevilla last week signing with a digital brand, similar to kind of probably, I mean, in terms of stature, you'd probably say comparable to maybe an Aston Villa, who managed to get a deal with Cazoo last year. So perhaps that will be the avenue in which where that revenue can be replaced, I guess, if gambling is to be phased out. So you're right, it is that tier of club, anywhere between kind of 10 and 20, I guess, that tend to go down the gambling route brand. I mean, Brighton is kind of different because it's, I mean, basically it's the home of the American Express headquarters, and it makes a lot of sense for that company to advertise with the biggest sports team in the city. But that's not the case everywhere else. Like there is not an Amex in every single town. So it's, yeah, that's where you kind of see those deals. And it's also interesting the kind of betting sponsor that you get. I mean, quite a lot of the time, like, I mean, LoveBet, have you ever used it? I haven't. Most of these companies are usually sort of Asia facing quite a lot of the time, and they will kind of advertise on the front of a Premier League shirt, not really to access the UK market, more to access the Premier League's global reach. So that's kind of how those deals are able to get done, and actually why a club like Burnley is able to charge as much as 7.5 million reportedly a year for that kind of inventory. So yeah, it will be if that goes, and there's rumblings that perhaps it could, it will be interesting to see what happens to the Premier League commercial behemoth, I guess. On that, I guess we should probably mention, although it doesn't come into play for this season, the Premier League's sort of rolling over its media rights deals and kind of what that means. I mean, I guess for the interim, probably not a lot, but perhaps where we will see the interest and where that story will develop is with the international market. So I think like the major one to come up quite soon is the US, where it's probably where the Premier League is probably hoping to secure a kind of a big piece of business.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned they're obviously rolling over their deals with Sky, BT, Amazon and BBC for 22 to 25. I think it's around 5 billion, isn't it? £5 billion. The most important thing about it is that other leagues would give a lot for that kind of stability, especially given that, as you mentioned, the Premier League will be pretty confident of getting more from its deals overseas. We already know that it's getting the same rights fee from its deal with beIN in the MENA region, which I'm pretty sure no other league has been able to achieve since they kind of been on their anti-piracy crusade. They've got renewals in with Canal Plus in France and Sky in Germany. I think those have both happened in recent months. And then there was obviously that 6-year, £2 billion deal they signed with Nent. I think that was at the beginning of last year, possibly. So yeah, there's kind of a lot of security there for the Premier League that other leagues don't have. You know, we all know about the issues that Liga is having following the collapse of its deal with Media Pro. I think you're probably getting quite tired about writing about that now, Tom. In Italy, you know, Serie A suffered a drop in value in its domestic rights tender recently. Took quite a while for it to get that over the line as well. Germany, a slight dip in value for the domestic rights cycle it's about to go into now. And then, you know, who knows what's going to happen to La Liga with now that a certain Lionel Messi is supposedly not going to be involved with that competition anymore. So I think, you know, just the fact that the Premier League has been able to roll over those deals, and it kind of continues this trend of them either consolidating in other markets. And as you mentioned, the US one there is likely to see a big increase. You know, NBC, the Premier League's been a feature of their offering for a really long time now. I remember I lived out there in 2004, and that was how long this sort of partnership goes back. And yeah, you've obviously got CBS with Paramount Plus adding a lot of football to their offering, ESPN as well, who recently did that big deal with La Liga. So you suspect there's going to be quite a few interested parties for that contract when the Premier League puts it up for tender.
Yeah, I can't believe you've overlooked the mega deal for the Scottish Premiership as well there, Sam, with Paramount Plus too. But you're right, like it's that kind of fact that you've got so many of these streaming products that have come online in the last year or so. They're all looking for football, like for football, essentially. Quite a lot of them have explicitly said so, and they've actually all paid more than they did last time for those deals. I imagine that the folks at the DFL, La Liga, and Serie A are all sort of pretty happy with how they've managed to do over there, and the Premier League is looking at what each of those has done and been like, right, we can't wait to get going. I can't pluck the former figure for the overseas rights off the top of my head, but it did. It was a massive boost to the Premier League clubs in the last rights cycle. Part of that will have been the big deal that they had with Tencent in China, which has not been replicated, I don't think, for this one. I mean, I don't think any kind of exact figure was reported for that, but it was significantly less this time around. Again, though, they've still managed to get a very broad distribution base with the new contract. So they've achieved, they've at least hit on some of those goals there. But yeah, I think the US will be where they kind of really look to kind of push those home, and it does provide that security. And I think, like, we've seen that, and I think this probably leads quite nicely actually into the kind of what we've seen this summer from the Premier League clubs. So while they've got that stability of their domestic rights, and they know that they're going to be getting more for those overseas ones, it's the only league really that's been spending any money as far as I can tell. I mean, PSG are a bit of an outlier. Like, they can basically, they're state backed and can afford to whatever the Qatari state fund wants it to. But Barcelona had to let Messi go because they literally couldn't afford his wages. Real Madrid are selling, like, one of the best defenders in the world at what seems to be a cut price for him because they want to balance their own books out to meet La Liga's wage caps. Yeah, the champions of Italy are literally having a fire sale over their squad. And Manchester City, on the other hand, are completing £100 million deals, and that they're not the only ones. Like, Chelsea are looking at spending 115 million on Lukaku. It seems to me that the Premier League, and at least the big clubs in the Premier League, have that's where you're seeing that security come through, is in the transfer windows.
Yeah, definitely. I don't even know if I'd describe it as, it's felt like an anomaly this summer, especially given that, you know, everyone across the other European leagues appears to be tightening the purse strings. I suppose there are a few teams in the Premier League that haven't necessarily spent as much as they maybe would have in previous windows. But, you know, it is just an increasingly regular occurrence now whereby Premier League clubs are outspending the other European competitions, you know, irrespective of whether a pandemic is happening or not. I'd said earlier that the Premier League hasn't been immune to the pandemic. But, you know, when you're looking at Manchester City spending £100 million on another midfielder, Chelsea, 115 million euros on Lukaku, United, 73 million pounds on Jadon Sancho. It just feels a little bit out of kilter with the financial difficulties that, you know, as you mentioned, seem to be striking down a lot of other leagues. And if anything, I don't know, the gap just seems to be maybe getting a little bit wider. You know, if anything, like, the Premier League is just strengthening while its rivals kind of appear to be getting a little bit weaker. I just feel like those signing of spending 100 million pounds on players, it's a statement in a way. It's almost saying, you know, our revenues are down because of the pandemic, but we haven't kind of been impacted by it in the same way that a lot of other clubs have. And, you know, because of that, the product is improving because of the addition of some of these big names as well. So
we're focusing on the top of the league here, but maybe there seems to be less spending going on elsewhere. Like, further down, the fees aren't changing massively there, I don't think. Although there has been quite a lot of player movement, I feel like there's kind of, you're seeing the kind of haves and have-nots at the moment a little bit. So Aston Villa, who were promoted like two seasons ago, but are well backed and appearing like apparently reasonably well run, it seems, are able to pick the pocket of the team like Southampton, who spent much more time recently in the Premier League and have had some pretty decent success over recent years, been able to kind of take their players and spend big money. And I mean, Aston Villa was trying to nick players away from Arsenal, which tells you that they're feeling pretty confident about where they are financially. Perhaps there's a kind of widening of the gap between the top, the middle and the bottom.
When you look at the teams that have been spending money, it is, you know, you just have to kind of look at their owners to understand why it is that they are spending money. You know, United are just, you know, they're like a McDonald's. They're just a massive brand. So, you know, they're still going to be able to sort of spend money regardless because of their commercial contracts, and which are just on a different scale to everyone else in the league. You mentioned PSG earlier being state-backed. You've got City in the Premier League, who for their owners' money seems to be no object. Similarly, Chelsea, you know, Roman Abramovich has been pumping money into that club for a very long time. Whether that is going to lead to, you know, a widening of the gap in the Premier League as well as between the Premier League and the other competitions, we're kind of, I guess that'll sort of all come out in the wash this season. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the teams lower down maybe have had their hands tied behind their back a little bit more this summer, but I suspect that it'll kind of be only a temporary thing. As we mentioned already, you know, they've got that security with their TV rights, the new deals coming in as well. They're still all receiving that money, and, you know, you'd imagine that after this season, there won't be any rebates to be paid either, like there have been in kind of the last couple. So, you know, the addition of one or two players for the top sides will sort of maybe widen that gap a little bit. But I wouldn't be worried too much about it.
Yeah, I guess you also get that kind of trickle down too. So Chelsea sign a big name striker, and that means that they've got to get rid of one who would probably walk into most teams in the Premier League. So there's that kind of ripple down. You'd like to think that those clubs will see some benefit to the Premier League strength, at least being a fan anyway.
Yeah, we're talking about wealthy owners. There have still been some kind of like rumours during the off season about clubs that maybe are for sale. Obviously, Newcastle one being the most obvious, where the sort of same situation feels like it's been playing out for the past sort of 3 or 4 years every summer. And they've had a very Newcastle-esque summer again, really, in that they haven't really signed anyone. I know Joe Willock's been linked, which, you know, has only renewed the appetite among their fans for Mike Ashley to get rid.
The details of this court case, I think, will kind of come out over various different points of the season. But I'm still not convinced that it will lead ultimately to a Saudi takeover of Newcastle. I feel like they'll be sold eventually, but I felt like that probably for the last 5 years. Maybe in a world where the Premier League does look a more stable investment in football, will lead to other clubs being moved on as well. So, I mean, Southampton have been sort of linked with a sale. Burnley, obviously, that happened last year. You feel like the Premier League maybe looks like a brighter investment in that regard, in terms of the kind of its ability to bounce back. I felt like last season we saw a lot of clubs in France being sold because maybe people saw that market as bottoming out. Maybe people looking for more secure investments would turn to England. I mean, Palace, for example, your team have been linked with a sale for a little while. Don't know whether or not that's the prospect of that happening is any closer, but it says everything, I think, that even that tier of club, which isn't even guaranteed European football, or they still present as attractive investment opportunities.
The Newcastle one's weird, isn't it? Because it's just been, with this going to court and everything, you know, that hearing has been delayed until early 2022 now. You just feel like, without wanting to borrow a term from Love Island, Mike Ashley has put all his eggs in that basket a little bit, whereas you feel like he might almost be better off turning his attentions elsewhere and, you know, trying to find a buyer that would actually have a better chance of getting through the Premier League's owners and directors test as well, because I honestly can't see how this one will go through, given Saudi Arabia's links to broadcast piracy, you know, given the Premier League's close ties to beIN, one of its key broadcast partners, who we know were a target of Saudi Arabia's BLQ campaign. So yeah, you do just wonder if it would be best for them to move on and try to find a more feasible buyer. I suppose the caveat with that is that, you know, there might not really be anyone out there with a spare £300 million lying around to spend in a Premier League club at the moment, because otherwise maybe it would have happened by now. But it's interesting you mentioned Palace, actually, because one thing that I did want to mention, something I spotted over the weekend during Palace's pre-season win against Watford.
Major.
At Selhurst Park, yeah, 3-1, Wilfred Zaha double. they were advertising virtual entertainment company Facebank. That might actually ring a bell for you, Tom, because they merged with Fubo TV last year. But interestingly, Facebank's founder is John Texter, who's an American businessman, and he's previously been linked with basically taking a minority stake at Benfica, but he's also been linked with joining the ownership group at Palace. I'm not sure how much to read into those adverts, but yeah, who knows? Maybe that could be a sign of something to come.
Yeah, one club I don't think will be sold, despite maybe the pleas of its fans, is Arsenal. Daniel Ek seems like a thoroughly nice tech bro, but with I'm sure very well intentioned, and I'm a big proponent of Spotify. You can listen to this podcast on Spotify, but I don't think he's going to be buying Arsenal anytime soon. Like, it seems like the Cronkies are pretty well embedded at the Emirates. There's no real financial pressure for them to sell. The team might be rubbish, but they are at least trying to spend money on places, including our third best defender from last year, RIP Ben White. But I just don't see that. I don't see that as a viable deal. What kind of will be interesting to see, I think, from the big clubs from an ownership perspective, is that they've all committed post Super League to putting members of fans on the board, or at least having some kind of fan representation on the board. And I think that would be an interesting narrative to follow, whether or not that actually kind of gets followed through in any meaningful way, or whether it's just one of those things that they said at the time to get people off their back.
Yeah, or how much say those fans will actually have in kind of any meaningful decisions. It's interesting you mention Arsenal. there as well, just on the, I know you kind of put Stan Kroenke up there as kind of among the most disliked owners in the league, sort of probably alongside Ashley, the Glazers, and also David Sullivan and David Gold at West Ham, who have also been linked with a potential takeover by a company called, well, a consortium called PAI Capital Limited. They've actually received the backing of former West Ham players and brothers, Rio and Anton Ferdinand. This consortium has basically said that they've provided proof of funds and met the asking price to buy the club. They've also said that they've held talks with the London Legacy Development Corp about taking full control of the London Stadium, which West Ham don't own. But yeah, then you've also got reports that Gold and Sullivan basically have no intention of selling and are saying privately that either the bid was derisory or that no formal offer had been made. It's just interesting, you know, we're mentioning a lot of these clubs here that are supposedly linked with takeovers or maybe up for sale. And, you know, the fact that a lot of them are the same ones that we're talking about every summer perhaps sort of just shows how hard it is to get a deal like this over the line. You know, there was a lot of talk when COVID arrived that it could lead to some bargains. I know you mentioned already possibly over in France where a lot of the clubs are in a worse financial situation. But I think what we've seen with the Premier League is that, you know, these clubs aren't distressed assets. Owners such as Mike Ashley, for example, aren't under pressure to reduce their asking price, and therefore they're not going to. So, you know, I'm not sure how many buyers will be willing to fork out the hundreds of millions of pounds, especially kind of given the pandemic situation that we are still kind of in. So, yeah, you know, even the last Premier League takeover, as you mentioned, involving Alan Pace at Burnley, that was leveraged using the club's own money. So, yeah, I don't know whether we are actually going to see another Premier League takeover anytime soon.
Maybe that leads us quite nicely into the latter section of this podcast, where we're going to just put out a few predictions. Maybe do you want to make a call on that? Do you think any Premier League clubs are going to be sold this season?
I'm going to say no, given that I just went off on one there about how I don't think it's how I don't think the kind of environment is right for it to happen. I suppose I almost think like the most, given that Newcastle's hearing is delayed until 2022. I suppose maybe the most likely one you'd perhaps say would be Southampton, given that they've also been up for sale for a while, kind of an attractive proposition with a good, you know, a good manager, decent stadium, good squad. I spend a kind of an owner who seems a little bit more willing to sell, and they supposedly had a deal in place with Joe De Grosser before he kind of pulled out back in June. So perhaps they would be the ones most likely if it was going to happen. But yeah, I'll go with no.
I'll go the other way, actually. I think one will be sold. I think it will come out of left field a little bit. We won't sort of hear about it too much. And suddenly it will just be announced that, I don't know, Brentford have been bought by a Venezuelan crypto merchant or something like that. I'm not going to sort of play, like, I'm not going to try and get too specific with it. But I think it will come massively out of left field. But there will be a club to change hands this year, based on no information whatsoever. So if you're a betting man, I'd go with Sam's well thought out argument. If you are a lover of losing money, then perhaps go with mine. Other predictions.
Yeah, sounds like you've had a tip there, Tom.
Other predictions then. Let's have a little think about who's going to... Yeah, how do you see, I don't know, the Premier League and the Premier League title and the top six shaking out this year?
Top six? Can we go to top four?
Okay, let's do top four then, if you can't think about six clubs in a league of 20.
Yeah, okay. So we're focusing now on sporting predictions rather than business ones. Let's, I think title, probably say, I would say City, but I think they need a striker. So basically, I think if City were to sign Harry Kane, they'd win the league pretty handsomely by like 5-10 points. But if they don't, I think Chelsea will win the league. I think Lukaku is a pretty big signing for them. They'll have players like Werner and Havertz who have had a season under their belts. Tuchel has had a bit longer to get his message across. And obviously they are the champions of Europe. So yeah, they look pretty strong to me. So if I say Chelsea for top, I think City will finish second. Third, I'll go with United and then Liverpool.
I think that United are going to win the league this year. I think that they have bought players in the right areas. They maybe get one more. And they weren't that far away from being pretty good last year. I like their defence. I like the addition of Sancho. And I just think that, like, I think that they could make a run at it. It's probably not the smart prediction, but that's my call. So for the rest of the top four, yeah, I don't think you can really look too far beyond the other three teams you mentioned, City, Liverpool, Chelsea. Spurs seem to be going backwards. Arsenal might get a little bit better. West Ham will go backwards, and Villa maybe bump themselves up into a Europa League spot. But as we know, it's all about the Europa Conference these days. So there's a lovely bit of compensation there.
No mention of Leicester.
At the other end, then I'll start off with my prediction for this. So I've been thinking about this for a little while, and I just think that Southampton are rubbish, and that is going to upset two members of the Sports Pro editorial team, my boss Mike and Ed Dixon, and I think Southampton are for the drop. Maybe that makes selling them easier. Maybe they'll be a bit cheaper for those Venezuelan crypto investors. But yeah, Southampton are going to go down alongside Norwich, who just are rubbish, and Brentford, who will have Brentford are going to have a great start to the season. Ivan Toney is going to score like 15 goals, but then they'll collapse when people figure out that they're actually not great at the back.
Interesting. Fair enough, Tom. Well, in the spirit of you annoying other members of our editorial team, I'll maybe bite back and say that Brighton are going to go down.
I knew this was coming.
Yeah, I thought if you'd let me go first, and you maybe could have counted the same Palace, but I'm not going to let you change it now. Should clarify for anyone listening that Tom is a Brighton supporter and I'm a Crystal Palace fan, which is why there is this kind of back and forth here. I don't just secretly hate Brighton. He doesn't just secretly hate Palace. But yeah, so I'll say Brighton alongside. Yeah, I think Norwich are probably right. I really want Brentford to stay up, so I'm going to say they're going to be fine. And I'm going to say that Watford are going to be the third ones. They seem like they're not quite as good as when they went down last time. So by that logic, I think they'll probably go down again.
All right. I mean, with that bombshell, I think that is probably a good place to wrap up the pod. Thanks very much for your prediction, Sam. Less so the Brighton ones. I feel like you're going to be woefully inaccurate on that. Thanks enough for coming, mate.
Yeah, cheers, Tom. Thanks for having me.
The Sports Pro Podcast is published by Sports Pro Media. The producer is Ed Dixon.